Hello and welcome to another episode of Podcast DX, the show that brings you interviews with people just like you, whose lives were forever changed by a medical diagnosis. I'm Lita. Ron is not with us today.
I know, he's in Honduras scuba diving.
Yes, he is.
I was going to say that he...
Oh, how nice!
Oh, yeah, and he left us here. No,
He's with he's a volunteer diver. He's also the he's the vice president of Dive Heart, and he's a volunteer diver this time to work with a participant that has cerebral palsy.
Oh, how wonderful!
Yeah, so he's
very
diving, but and you are again.
Oh, I'm occasionally Jean Marie.
Okay. Well, collectively, we're the host of Podcast DX. If we don't have fun with ourselves, nobody will. On today's show, we're speaking with We're speaking with Kathleen O'Shea.
Kathy is good.
She's a professor of English at Monroe Community College in Rochester, New York. She's a 43-year-old migraine sufferer who has taken her passion for literature and her chronic illness to create so much more than a headache. That's the name of the book. And the subtitle is Understanding Migraine Through Literature. Kathy is joining us today to talk about migraines. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me on your show. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Oh, we're thrilled to have you on. And I was going to say, I'm trying to pull up your book right now. We have it on Kindle. We're still, our hard copies are on the way. I wanted to know if you could start us off and tell us about your experience living with migraine headaches.
Yeah, it's been, so I'm 59 and I've had migraines since I was 14. So I became a chronic migraine sufferer when I was in my mid 30s, when I had to have a complete hysterectomy due to endometriosis, actually. And so when I came out of that surgery, I went into chronic migraine. It was intractable. We couldn't get out of the cycle. So I've been a chronic migraine sufferer ever since. And living with it is, I consider it, you know, through much of the literature that I've read, you know, some people refer to it as a companion in life. I don't know if I want to call it a companion in the sense that that sounds like a positive word. And I think it's got a positive connotation, but it is a part of my life every single day of my life in some way, shape or form.
Right. Okay. So what type of migraines do you normally have?
So mine are pretty classic, although, you know, I've noticed in, I just wrote a blog on Psychology Today. I do a bi-weekly blog on migraine for that. And I just did one on aging with migraine. And what I've noticed is that in recent years, my migraines have changed somewhat. I mean, I've added symptoms, in other words, that I didn't used to have. But my migraines have always been quite classic. I don't have aura, but of course, you know, many people think all migraine sufferers get aura, but actually only 20 to 30% of migraine sufferers have aura. I don't have aura, but what I do get are a lot of warning signs that something bad is coming and I better do something about it. And so if I can, I use one of my many rescue medications, which have different tiers to them in terms of, you know, what you take when. And once the warning signs come, my migraines usually begin in the neck. There's a particular place I can point to it right now in the neck. Well, of course, you can't see that. But anyway, in the right side of my neck. And then the pain comes up over my right eye. And that's when I'm in a full-blown attack.
Okay.
But there are many different levels of migraine, you may well know, and it's a cycle that continues, and sometimes you can completely come out of it, and sometimes you're only partially out of it.
Right. Yeah, and they are no fun, and as it says, it's so much more than a headache, indeed, because it can be,
nauseating.
Yeah, as We both
Yeah, that's one thing about it.
we both have headaches today, and we're both hoping that neither one of us has a migraine. How have you and your healthcare team? You said that you have something to take. Are you also taking preventative medications? How have you decided to treat your migraines?
So that's changed so much over the years. As you well know, the treatment for migraine has changed a lot, and really we've developed some really, you know, great advances in the last 5 years. But prior to that, when I was only 14, very little was known about migraine. So in fact, it was very difficult to diagnose. And then once it was diagnosed, nobody knew how to treat it. So as you may well know, most in fact, all migraine medications up until the last 5 years have been medications that have been designed and created for something else.
Right.
And then they happen sometimes to work for migraine. And so a lot of trial and error. And even now, it's a lot of trial and error. I take several preventative medications morning and night. And I also, you know, obviously have the series of rescue medications as well. But I also use a Cepheli device. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
We've heard of it, yeah.
I use that on a daily basis. I'm a great advocate for it.
Okay.
And I think it helps in preventative, but also a lot if I'm in the early stages of a migraine, and it'll often can abort it.
Okay.
Okay. Well, that's good to know.
That's wonderful. And I was actually surprised to learn, because again, you know, there wasn't a lot out there until quite recently, but some of the medications had been studied since the 1950s. But they just they went through
at least one of the ones that just came out
was just released for migraines. They had been studying it since the 1950s
for migraines,
and for some reason it never went to fruition until recently. And I was kind of shocked to see something like that, because there were so many people out there suffering at the time that really could have used something. Yeah,
sure.
Yeah, I think a lot of the medications and this. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No.
We do it all the time. go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that I think part of the problem there is that, you know, we've been fighting for years the advocates and medical professionals have been fighting for years for more research and more money federally, you know, from the government, because I don't want to make a quote, but in terms of money, but it's like, it's so little devoted to migraine versus, say, something like diabetes or other diseases that are ongoing. So, you know, it's only been in the last few years that really some of these studies have been brought to fruition and then finally gone through the stages where they've proven their efficacy for use.
I wonder if the funding is limited to, I mean, I hate to say this, but people that are more important, that have something wrong with them more than just pain. It seems like
pain
is ignored in our medical society so much. It's like,
because it seems like it's subjective.
Right.
And
right.
And it's very difficult.
Anything that has to do with
measure.
Right. Anything that has to do with if the whole problem is pain, but nothing more than that. It seems like we get ignored.
Well, there's a lot more than.
Okay. I know, but I'm just saying. It seems like there's a problem with that.
Well, I think you might be referring to chronic illness, because chronic illness, you know, includes a lot of pain, but it includes a lot of other symptoms too.
Right.
And I think that chronic illness has been largely ignored. In fact, the whole chapter in my book is about the invisibility of migraine, because you're not walking around with a broken leg, you know, so people can see anything.
Right.
And so you do everything in your power to make the appearance that you're functioning and you're functioning okay. And so it's an invisible illness. And so it gets largely ignored.
Right. Kathy, do you have any migraine triggers that you're aware of, like smells or sounds or anything like that? Yeah.
Sure. No, I've been fortunate that I've not had food triggers, as a lot of people do, or I don't have scent triggers. But I know I really appreciate the offices that there's one office I go to for my physical therapy treatment that treats my migraines, where they're fragrance free. I mean, they don't allow anyone to walk in the door with the fragrance. And that's really, something that I wish more medical professional offices that deal with migraine would be aware of, is that lighting, for instance, is real important. So there are certain sensitivities that people with migraine, when they're in migraine, are really can trigger one. For me, my triggers are definitely stress, as would be the number one trigger. And as we know now, there's what we call letdown migraine, and that's what I suffer a lot from. So in other words, I can get through the stressful event, whatever it might be. And this can be a positive stressful event or a negative one. And I can get through the event itself, and then about 1 to 2 days later, I get a full-blown attack. So stress is a huge trigger for me. Also, I get a real sensitivity to sound. But like all of a sudden, any normal sound will just kind of set me off. So I have warning signs and I have triggers, and stress or any sudden movement of my neck in a particular way can set one off as well. I've been very limited actively. I used to be very involved in sports and that kind of thing. I've been very limited because of the neck, and I have to be so careful of that.
I had a question, Kathy. Have you ever been diagnosed, or has anybody ever talked to you or considered cervical instability as a source of your migraines?
Oh, I think that's very much for the, I mean, mine are cervicogenic migraines. So I've been treated that way, and I've gotten in the injections to try to, to try to treat those. However, I've had all kinds of injections to try to treat them. But the one problem is that no place anywhere near Rochester, New York, will touch the C1, C2 joint, which is really where
Correct.
I need. But it's so dangerous in terms of, or many people, many doctors consider it so dangerous.
Wait,
But I've been desperate enough that I would try it, and my headache, former headache specialist, he's retired now, unfortunately. He had tried to help me find somebody that would do it.
Sometimes they'll do it under radiographic, as part of a radiographic thing,
Yeah.
where they'll have it. Yeah, you're under your they're. You're, it's a live X-ray while they're injecting in.
There's a firm, I know they're not close to you. There's a firm in Miami called Caring Medical, I believe. He's on the doctor
Well,
is
you
on.
can send her info.
I will send
So
you some
we'll
info, but
yeah,
I don't
that would be
mind.
wonderful.
Yeah,
Thank you.
he does that radiographic
Well,
specific.
and the University of Chicago as well. So,
Right, and Dr. Bolognese is
I've
there
had
too, isn't
also
he?
the I've had the facet joint injections as well. Yeah, and they do that radiographically as well.
All
right.
And
But I appreciate any information for
Sure.
sure.
Oh yeah, I think that's part of what we're doing is, what advice do you have for someone else, and what can help, may help other people who are just learning about this condition or whose family members are living with it on a day-to-day basis. Kathy,
Sure, definitely.
so what do you do? What is your protocol when you know a migraine's coming? Do you act right away, or do you wait till it's full blown? And what do you do to help, like comfort
That's an
yourself?
excellent question, because it's a complex question, actually. Or the answer is complex, because actually because of insurance companies, and the difficulties and obstacles that they present. So, in other words, I have like a regimen that I start out with. I use diclofenac first. That would be at first sign. Then I go to Ubrelvy, would be my next attempt. And then I use Trudhesa, which has been quite effective for me. That's a fairly new drug, and that has been effective. And then I also, on a monthly basis, use the injections for Emgality, which is the CGRP. that I use.
Okay.
I've been through several of them, and they've been effective for a period of time and then less so. Here's the complication, because Ubrelvy, I think, is one of the best drugs that came out recently. And yet you only, okay, so by definition, someone with chronic migraine has 15 days or more a month with migraine, okay? Some level of it.
Mm-hmm.
And yet the insurance companies will give you 8 Ubrelvy.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, I've been told that I get more than a lot of people do. And 8 is never going to be close to enough to treat a month's worth of migraine. Same thing with Trudhesa. You get a very, limited number of them. So you always have to play the game. So coming back to your question, do I wait till it's full blown? Do I attack it early? I have to weigh all of that. I have to say to myself, boy, I'm getting, like, I have the pain that I talk about in my neck right now. Do I take one of those now, or do I save it because it, maybe it really won't develop and maybe I need to save some.
Right.
So those are really difficult issues that migraine sufferers deal with. I had a lot of responses to one of those blogs. I did a blog on that problem, and I had more comments on that than probably any of the other ones I'd done.
Okay. I believe it.
Yeah. I feel you. Yeah. Every time I get my little bottle of even Imitrex, and I'm like, really?
Yeah.
How is this going to get me through a month? But you do what you can.
Exactly.
And it can be very difficult. And
have you been having Botox injections quarterly?
Oh, that's right. I'm glad you mentioned it. Yeah, I definitely get them. And here's another problem here.
Mm-hmm.
And again, with insurance company. Mm-hmm. I probably have nothing I've been more frustrated with over the years than with this. I'm definitely a believer in Botox. For me, I know it doesn't work for everybody, but for me, and I know that it lasts 9 weeks for me. It's almost like by the calendar,
exactly.
It's going to last 9 weeks.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And 2 months ago, I was, going back, I've been given it every 12 weeks, and I knew 12 weeks wasn't enough because I would start it, I would start a migraine, get a lot of migraines beginning in week 10.
Right.
So my headache specialist who retired would give me nerve blocks once a week in that intervening time to try to get me through.
Right.
Okay. Then he fought the insurance company and he was able to get me Botox every 10 weeks.
Oh.
So for a few years, I had it every 10 weeks. Then in January, I get a notification from the insurance company saying that under no circumstances would they allow Botox for fewer than 12 weeks.
Right.
So I'm back to 12 weeks.
Right.
So what happened to me is 2 months ago, I went into a month-long terrible cycle where I was suffering every single day, and I knew it was at least in part because I couldn't get that Botox.
Now, what Jean's neurologist has told her regarding the timing of the Botox is not so much that it's an insurance restriction,
but it's also
a safety.
Right. It's safety, and also it will become you will eventually supposedly come to a point where it's not going to be effective, because you will actually have denervation, and that can be problematic as well. But I hear what you're saying about timing, and it's very difficult.
Because Jean is in her last month. She gets her Botox next week, so
it's
the migraines have been since, like you say, after 9 weeks, it's up.
Right. But it does show you how effective they are. Effective,
yes,
for you.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And yes,
then,
exactly.
And
the only thing I would ask is, go ahead.
No.
Well, I was going to say the only thing that she does for that last month is lay on bags of ice.
Yeah, I was going to ask.
Yeah. Yes. Oh, I was living like that for that month.
Right. Right.
And that's the thing. If you're going to deny that, then like for instance, the neurologist that I'm working with now, doesn't do nerve blocks. And so I have no way of getting the nerve blocks in between now. So, it's, they need to come up with something that's going to help their patients that in the intervening time.
Okay. Agreed.
Yeah.
Kathy, what do you think the biggest misconception is regarding migraines?
Then it's just a headache. I mean, that's one reason that it's part of so much a part of my book. It's because, you know, for me, and I know most migraine sufferers, the headache is one part of it. But it affects the whole being. It affects your whole being. It affects your cognitive abilities. You know, I'm an English professor, and I find myself when I'm suffering from any part of the cycle of migraine, often getting word drop, mm-hmm. which is rather embarrassing in front mm-hmm. of a class. But I get word and I get clumsy. And, you know, often people say that people with migraine look like they're under the influence mm-hmm. because you're kind of clumsy and you bump into things. And
right.
and I do all those things. And, you know, I'm easily confused. I have trouble focusing and concentrating. I get mood swings. I get that real sensitivity to sound. So it affects, and there's something about it that's indescribable. And I think that's where the literature comes in that's so mm-hmm. wonderful, because it's indescribable to explain to somebody, again, when we say it affects the whole being, exactly what that means. But you only know it when it finally lifts. Mm-hmm. And the whole, you know, and I always call it something actually lifts out of my body and I become a normal human being again for whatever period of time. So it's, I think that's the biggest misconception, that a migraine is just a bad headache. And so can you take, why don't you take a couple of Advil? You know, and you know, we've all heard the many, you know, pieces of advice people give us that clearly have, are, you know, not, you know, they have good intentions, right. but have no clue.
Right.
And are not educated on what migraine is.
Right.
I know. I liked the way the writer of Migraine Mafia was describing realizing that, you know, a migraine is there and trying to explain it and then being told, oh, well, you probably went to bed with wet hair. And it's like, oh.
Yeah, right, yeah. Right, right. Wait, I know that passage.
How
exactly.
Does that work?
I use that passage when I'm doing a book reading because I find that so, it just,
it's very relatable.
It kind of really captures it all.
Yes, and it's very relatable.
Yep.
When someone has never experienced a migraine, it's hard for them, I think, to understand.
Right.
And yeah, we are very sympathetic.
And also, if you encountered people that say that, oh, I have migraines too, you know, because they don't really understand, and you know, they don't really understand migraine.
Right.
But because they describe it as just, you know, a bad headache mm-hmm. that they get. So people are just flippant,
yeah.
kind of under, but that, I don't mean it intentionally so.
No,
but,
right.
You know,
they
it's just
don't
a
understand
sense
and
of
they just
being
can't
misunderstood.
Connect. Yeah, can't connect.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. Kathy, when someone mentions, you know, Jane Austen, Emily Dickinson, or Virginia Woolf, I will forever now think of your book, So Much More Than a Headache, Understanding Migraine Through Literature. And I have to know, what inspired you to seek out accounts of migraines in literature? How did that come about?
You know, I actually remember the very day, but it began with me just, I was in an intractable migraine. My headache specialist, to whom I dedicated this book, by the way, had just retired. And I was in this long migraine and I felt very alone and I felt very kind of helpless. And I was having a lot of trouble. We had that's another big problem we have in the United States is so few people focusing on becoming headache specialists. We have a very small percentage of medical professionals that are going into that. And anyway, he retired and I was having a lot of difficulty getting into someone new. And because he had 300 patients. And
wow.
I remember I was at work and I was suffering from this migraine, you know, for so long. And I thought, what are you doing? You're not turning to that which you always turn to in times of help helplessness and crisis and kind of hopelessness. Mm-hmm. And that's literature. I mean, I've always believed in that literature captures the essence of all forms of joy and pain, and that, you know, readers of all ages and backgrounds can connect with grief and struggle. So I that day went back to my office and I remembered this one essay that I had read it in grad, well, read it when I was a graduate assistant and thrown into teaching a freshman comp class and said, here's the book you're going to be using. And I opened up the book, and the very first essay in the book was called In Bed by Joan Didion. And I remembered that how profoundly that impacted me mm-hmm. when I first read it, because I thought, you know, this person really gets it. I mean, mm-hmm. and can describe it in a way that I never could. Mm-hmm. So I reread it, you know, as a way of coming back to that, which always helps me, which is literature. And then I got to thinking that very day I was in my office and I got to thinking, there must be other migraine sufferers who are celebrated writers, you know, mm-hmm. that have written about migraine or created, you know, personas who have migraine. And so for my own sake, I started looking into this. And then the more and more I found, I thought, oh my God, you know, other people could benefit from this mm-hmm. and, you know, and feel they're less alone, which is what literature is so wonderful for.
Sure. Wonderful. Yes.
Yeah, and actually, I'm just thinking about all the times I'll be, you know, reading something and one of the characters, like you said, will have a medical condition. And it's just a fascinating look at that condition through day-to-day life. Like there are several books about with a character who has synesthesia, where like when they hear mm-hmm. something, they mm-hmm. see a color or, yeah, and I'm just, it's fascinating. It's such a unique thing to add. And then, like you said, it's hard sometimes to find the words to describe what you're going through. And when you see it on the page, it's, I don't want to say it's welcoming. It's comforting. It's definitely comforting.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. I thoroughly yeah. enjoyed reading your book.
I appreciate that. Yeah.
And I do want to like get a copy for everyone in my family who's ever suggested apple cider vinegar to take care of my
I haven't gotten that one.
Oh. Yeah, I was like,
oh. It can, you know, that can be so frustrating too, can mm-hmm. it? I mean, uh-huh. it's you know, living with migraine is hard enough, but it's very wearing and enervating, you know, when people don't understand, the people around you even don't understand and aren't trying to understand. And that takes a lot out of you too.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
And okay, sorry.
Kathy, could you walk us through your writing process? And basically, I'm just wondering, is it something that you want to try to get that frustration and energy out in writing? Or is it something that you do when you're in a lull and you say, oh, okay, now I can breathe and I'm just going to go ahead and relax and write down some things?
And I want to know, how did you pick and choose which works were going to be in your anthology?
Oh, these are great questions.
We have a million questions for you. I know we only have so much of your time. Otherwise, we would keep asking.
No, I'm happy. I love talking about it. So as I mentioned, I never intended on writing a book. Mm-hmm. That was never my intention. You know, it's just that when I finally had this realization that I was finding so many in poetry and fiction and nonfiction and even the play, that I thought, you know, wow, this really could become something that would help other people. And so my writing process, actually, it was so therapeutic for me. I mean, I know it's kind of cliched that writing is therapeutic, but when I decided I wanted to try to write a book proposal and I wanted to try to, you know, do this for other people, it got me so passionate about working on it that it really became more than an outlet. It was like I would be done. I'd go to work, and when I left work, I'd go to Barnes & Noble, and I would research, and I'd write, and I'd find more and more and more. And that was the most enjoyable part, obviously, of writing the book. And then, adding my own kind of two cents about what these works were about. And then making the decision, and this kind of comes back to your question about like how did I decide who to include? I decided ultimately, rather than making this a kind of chronological study of literature and migraine, because I do have like a medieval poet and we come up to some very current, very important writers right now. But I decided, no, that's not what people want. I think what we should do is to organize it around themes related to migraine, that those of us that live with migraine either want to share with others or, so they better understand, or that we can relate to. So that's when I picked the five themes that I would organize the book around. And then I decided on what were the, and one of the problems I had was that some of the pieces, and I think from having read this, which I appreciate, is that some of the pieces could have gone in more than one chapter. That they there's a lot of overlap there. And so I did have to make some tough decisions in those cases. I'd say though that the most, I don't know how much you want to know about the actual, once I finished the first draft of the book, what happened after that. But well, so I, when you're looking for a publisher, that's a tough task. And but I really was fortunate because I came upon Kent State University Press, which did a series on literature and illness. I think it was, I can't remember, that's not the exact title of it, but they had a series on literature and illness. And so it seemed like when I read about what that series was about, I'm like, oh my gosh, this is a perfect fit for this publisher. But then, of course, you've got to go through the whole proposal process and convince them that it is, and it's a much lengthier process than people would think. And then it goes through other readers who are experts in the field. So I, it was the book was sent out to, before they would even give me a contract, for sure, they sent it out to a headache specialist to read and also and review, and also an academic scholar. So because there's those are sort of the two kind of fields that would be obvious to be reviewing the book. So they send back all their feedback and comments, and whether or not they think the book's worthy of publication, or whether it's only worthy if I make the corrections they want, that kind of thing. And then you go through the major, so then there's the process where I have to address every single point that they've made and say whether or not I agree that that would be a good change, or whether, or make an argument that I really want what I have there to stay there and why. And then from there, you get, yeah, it just goes on from
Yeah,
there.
that's pretty intense,
Well,
really.
and I think I also read that just getting the rights to utilize some
Oh,
of the works was a bit of a task.
more than a task. If this was the hardest part about the book, and presented the biggest obstacles for me, because imagine getting permission for Joan Didion's In Bed. I mean, she's a one of the most celebrated authors and talented, great authors. Obviously recently passed, but getting rights to her, or like Hilary Mantel, who's like a really well-known writer now. I mean, she's putting out great books now. And so getting these, you have to get the permissions to the publishers, and they all have these detailed forms you have to fill out, and then they send you their price. And so, for instance, I was running up against a couple of essays in it from the New York Times. The New York Times used to run a column on migraine, and some great writers wrote pieces for it, and they were charging me $400 a piece to use these very short articles. Well, I had no funding, right? I mean, this was just, here I am, a community college professor, and I'm just trying to do something good. If it were not for, and I would like to give credit to Dr. Frederick Godley, who is the president of the Association of Migraine Disorders, a very major migraine organization. and an important one. He believed in my, the inception of my project. Like, I was looking for funding to help me with permissions, and he found out, he really wanted to help support me, but he found out in the process that since I was not a non-for-profit, that his organization itself could not provide me with funding. So what did he do? Talk about belief in a project and propelling me to pursue it. He wrote me a check, and that check is the only way I was able to come up with the funding to get all of these permissions, because they cost over $10,000.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow.
So
wow.
I guess one of the biggest problems, and this relates to something you were talking about, but another problem is that I find after publishing the book is, first of all, it got published during COVID. Oh. And that's no good time to get a book published, right. Trust me.
Yeah.
Because, you know, any opportunity to share it with others is shut right down.
Right.
But I also found that many organizations, migrant organizations and support groups, don't want you promoting your book on their pages. Now, I understand that in one sense, mm-hmm. That they don't want a lot of self-promotion and all of that. But what I think that they fail to understand in large part is that I'm never going to make a penny on this book. You know, what people don't understand is the percentage of what the author gets
right.
per book mm-hmm. is just, you know, so minuscule. And I'll never come back to the $10,000 that I made, you know, I mean, that was spent on the writing of the book. Mm-hmm. So I'm not looking to make money. I'm looking to mm-hmm. share the book mm-hmm. so that others can benefit from it.
Perfect segue. Kathy, how can the family and friends of those individuals living with migraines benefit from reading your book?
Because they're all getting it for Christmas or the winter holidays.
We're giving
oh, yeah.
them away.
Everyone's getting it for winter holidays this year.
Wonderful. I so appreciate that. It means a lot to me. They can benefit from it because they can better understand it, understand the condition by reading about different accounts of it. They may see their loved one in one of those characters, for instance. Not every piece is going to benefit everybody. Not every piece is everybody going to connect with. But even if you find that one piece and you say that there's that wow moment of, wow, this person, I better understand it. And the other thing is, it's also aimed at medical professionals who, because, and family and friends, because they can develop empathy. They can mm-hmm. actually learn to put their loved one, you know, put themselves in their loved one's shoes, mm-hmm. which I think people who don't yet have an understanding of it cannot do. But if you read enough accounts of other people who are dealing with a lot of the same things that your loved one is dealing with, you start to say, yeah, that makes sense. And this is real. Mm-hmm. And I need to pay more attention to it.
Right. That's wonderful. And definitely the reason where everyone's getting one for the holidays this year. And I think you can even, you notice it even when you seek out medical care in your head, or you're seeking out medical care for something else and you have a migraine. If someone, in that medical group understands migraines, they'll put you in a room and turn off the lights. They'll give you a cold wash rag, possibly to put on your
yes.
eyes or the back of your neck, and those, or even an ice pack. And those little things make such a huge difference. And I know
they really do.
Yeah. So I think if you haven't experienced one yourself, this is a wonderful way to, like you said, get in that mindset and kind of walk in someone's shoes that experiences migraines. And not only one person, but because it's an anthology, you get to see a whole spectrum of different versions of what a migraine can be like for someone, just as everyone has their
yes.
you know, has their own experience with migraines. And it's a wonderful idea. I love it. And I have to also ask, how has reading about migraine headaches and literature helped you personally, and how, like you said, it was therapeutic. How else did writing this book help you? Despite not financially, I guess it didn't help you financially. Sorry.
Yeah, right. Well, obviously there's the exhilaration of having actually produced something that you think can help others. I think it's also, I've really enjoyed, you know, like opportunities like this to talk mm-hmm. with other people who suffer from migraine and get it. And but also that you're like, you know, podcasts like yours, where you're willing to take your time to kind of share for others, you know, what migraine is. I think that, so I've had, you know, opportunities for interviews. I'd love to do more book readings and discussions, that kind of thing. So it's really, even the, once the book was published, it's still been at the kind of forefront, aside from my own teaching career, at the forefront of what I do and what I care about.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, finding ways to help communicate with others. I've had people in the Rochester area, for instance, you know, asked to meet with me just to talk with me about, you know, a lot of it is they want to share their experience, which is understandable. And I'm more than willing to listen, because I think that, you know, as you alluded to, because it's an anthology, people can better understand that it's hard to treat because everybody's symptoms and triggers are so different. I mean, there are a lot of similarities, but there are a lot of differences as well.
Right.
And I think you can see, you know, how you've staged things up. I'm having aphasia right now. it's so much fun. How you've organized things and the time and the care that you put into this, you can tell that it was a passion project. And, it's that aspect of it is wonderful to see as well. And we were so excited to find out that you're going to be on the show. Because once we read the book, we were like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. We were very, very excited.
So Kathy, what are the chances that you're going to start doing anthologies and compiling other stories relating to other healthcare conditions? Maybe a book on COVID or the lockdown experience?
Well, you know, I'm going to be completely honest with you. I don't, because I don't have this, I don't have the same connection. I probably don't have the passion right now, anyway, to do that, to pursue that. The only thing I would say is it, you know, maybe something with the comorbidities of migraine,
okay. Mm-hmm.
Because there's so many of those that a lot of people aren't familiar with, and many I'm not familiar with. So I, you know, I might pursue something, you know, in a writing project around that.
Okay. I just don't want you to slow
down.
I've
also, thank you. I appreciate that. I don't either. And I'm kind of looking for what niche that might mm-hmm. be, but I have a feeling, like I've thought about, my husband has suggested that I, because the so many experiences I've had with migraine are so vivid to me,
mm-hmm.
and I've taken so many turns in my life with migraine and how they've changed and developed and so forth over the years, that maybe I do some sort of a kind of memoir, I guess, mm-hmm. of
yep.
that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how much appeal that would have for others, but it certainly would be good for me to do
mm-hmm.
for myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where you have to start as a writer.
Mm-hmm.
You have to want to do it for yourself.
Right.
Right.
And even stories, if you want to include stories about the origins of some of the medications. Like, I was horrified
yeah.
to find out that one of my medications comes from hamster ovaries. And I was like,
oh,
you've
dear.
Got to be kidding me.
Sometimes I might not want to know that.
Yeah. Well, when I found that out, I was like, this is really
bizarre.
Odd. This is very odd. But you know,
very,
very odd. But yeah. So I'm sorry to all the hamsters who have been
yes, absolutely
on my behalf. Yeah, but we would look forward to seeing any future work from you. We'd be thrilled to sign up to get our advanced copy. But Kathy, I have to ask, because you said that you know, your husband was. Your husband was suggesting that you might want to write a memoir. And I'm curious, what support have you received during your healthcare journey and also during your writing journey? And what role have friends and family played in both of these aspects of your life?
That's a great, great question. I'm blessed, absolutely blessed with my family and friend support. My husband has been, I've been married for 34 years, and he's been, and obviously I've had migraine for over 34 years. So he's been through it all. My parents, just bless them. I'm fortunate they're still alive. And they, from the time I was 14, and so little was known about migraine, they did anything and everything they could to find help for me. And they have been my A number one supporters, just all my life. And I know the number one dream I had was that the book would come out. My dad was going, I almost lost my dad and thought I was going to lose him. This was during just before COVID hit. But it was so imperative for me that that book got in his hands before he died. And it did. And that was a great moment for me. But so I've had wonderful support from family, and I have a few close friends that really get it. And the beautiful thing about them is they want to get it. I mean, they want to keep, they read everything I write, all my blogs, everything on my Facebook page. They read and support. And then, they're very supportive to me personally. In terms of medical care, I've had my ups and downs, but I had one headache specialist for 16 years, the doctor I referred to that I dedicated the book to, who I God bless him, I think he saved my life. And the best thing about him, and this is something I would hope for anybody suffering migraine, is that you continue to seek out that person who not only gets it, but is staying current with all the different treatments that are available and coming, and also is encouraging that person. When you leave their office, they say, if this doesn't work, there's always something more we can try. Instead of saying, I don't know what else to do for you, which, and I've heard many people experience, and I actually once experienced myself, and there's nothing harder to deal with than that.
Yeah,
I don't know if I answered your question.
Yes, you
I
did.
think you did. Yeah, your family and healthcare providers.
We're both
Absolutely.
helpful.
Yes.
And friends.
And
And
friends.
friends,
Yeah,
yes.
can't forget friends. That's
But
all.
not everybody has all that.
No,
That's the problem.
right. And
Right.
it can be, yeah.
Kathy, what additional tips, hints, or advice do you have for somebody recently diagnosed with migraines?
There's several things. One is to you have to be patient. That would be a tip, because it takes time to find the right doctor, the right combination of doctors and treatments. So, for instance, I have a team. I call them a team, because I see not only my neurologist, but I see a chiropractor, and I see a physical therapist who specializes in chronic migraine, in cervicogenic chronic migraine. Weekly, I see her. And so it's a combination of finding a team of people that work with you. And I think I also would suggest that somebody who's just been diagnosed go to one of the major migraine organizations. For instance, the National Headache Foundation, the American Headache Society, the Association of Migraine Disorders. These are all great sites that actually will help you find. They have directories that will help you find neurologists and headache specialists in your location. So you can actually try to look that way. And also, they have wonderful resources available. So they're great sites to go to. They're very informative, and they're run by, medical professionals in headache and migraine.
That you don't have to be alone in this world.
Yes.
No, you don't. And sometimes, that's one of the hardest parts about, is feeling alone, and you don't have to be.
Well, Kathy, thank you so much for joining our show today. How can our listeners learn more about you and get a copy of your book?
Thank you for that. You can learn more about me by going to my Facebook page, which is Migraine Lit, and there you'll learn about me. But also, I put on a lot of different migraine information, and other articles that I find to be valuable for from some of these organizations, for instance. There, I also have a bi-weekly migraine blog for Psychology Today. I've done 36 articles now for them. And I'm also on LinkedIn and Twitter, and I have a website. It's www.migrainelit.com. And if you feel like it, I also on YouTube have a book trailer so that you can really get an overall feel of the book and what its goals are. And it gives a few passages from it. It gives you a good feel for the book.
Well, I'm definitely going to put links for all of those on our webpage.
Yes, absolutely.
I would really appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us.
Yes. If our listeners have any questions or comments related to today's show, they can contact us at podcastdx@yahoo.com, through our website, podcastdx.com, on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, TikTok, or Instagram.
And if you have a moment to spare, please give us a review wherever you get your podcast. As always, please keep in mind that this podcast is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment, and always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment or before undertaking a new healthcare regime. And never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking it because of something you've heard in this podcast.
Till next week.